Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
With less money and fewer firefighters, departments have to use their people in the smartest and safest ways. So the next time you're speccing an apparatus, think manual and remote control monitors. Why, TFT practically reinvented radio frequency handheld controls for monitors, flowing from 15 up to 2,000 gallons per minute. Since every firefighter counts, so does every purchase. We can help maximize your team's Firestream's performance today. Visit us at www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686.
Welcome to the Apparatus Architects here on Radio at Firehouse.com. The show is hosted by Tom Shand and Mike Wilbur. We have another show packed with a lot of industry news breaking here towards the end of the year, and we'll hear about that in a second. If you do have any questions or comments for the Apparatus Architects, please do send us an email to podcast@firehouse.com. Mike, Tom, let's get the show underway.
Peter, thanks so much. Tom Shannon, Mike Rover here, and it's towards the end of the year. There's an awful lot of things that go on in terms of administration changes sometimes in fire departments as well as within the apparatus industry. So since our last podcast, there's been numerous changes out there, and Mike, why don't you fill in the listeners here as to what's going on today?
Thanks, Tom. Thank you very much. Just some of the apparatus manufacturing-related news. Emergency One from Ocala, Florida, in an article posted in the Ocala local newspaper. Their future is in doubt. They had a $6 million loss in the third quarter of 07, and their total year-end loss could be up to $12 million. And it was unclear, as we go to broadcast here, exactly what was going to happen to that company, whether they were going to continue on or whether it would be sold or something else. We'll certainly keep our listeners posted with that as developments warrant. The CEO of Seagrave, Scott Mintner, resigned earlier this month. Also, the CEO of American LaFrance has also resigned. And Elite Fire Apparatus, that we talked a little bit about in last month's show, who had the large contract for Montgomery County, Maryland, that was not going to be fulfilled, has now entered a receivership. A court ordered a receiver named, and their financial woes continue as we broadcast today, and we'll certainly follow up on all that at the beginning of next year. Other headlines making news. How about this? A Canadian fire truck responding mutual aid to the U.S. in intercountry mutual aid was stopped at the border for a number of minutes before it was allowed to continue through. Wallingford, the fire district voters rejected a request for a purchase of a new fire truck by a narrow 7-vote margin. And we talk about that often, that it's very difficult at times to get funding for new equipment, especially as the costs rise, and that is just a sign of the times. Pennsylvania residents say that a firefighter was drunk when he crashed the truck. A woman sues a Chester firefighter over a wreck that they had. Firefighters donate apparatus to Kentucky colleagues. We're seeing a lot more of that as the fire service kind of mirrors the general populace as becoming the haves and the have-nots. And fortunately, we have big hearts in the fire service, and those that have tend to give to those that have not. Another headline, J.C. firefighter suspended after arriving at work naked. Can't make that one up, Tom.
You know, Mike, that sounds like something that maybe you would see someplace else. But no, that's pretty interesting. You know, maybe in that particular department's case, maybe that was considered full protective gear. Who knows, you know? Maybe their SOGs are a little different than ours.
Amen to that. Next headline, Renton fire recruit allegedly steals the fire chief's car. I guess his future on the job is in question.
I think he was going for that chief's aide job right off the top there, Mike. I don't think he wanted to be assigned. He was one of those guys, you know, like, unlike you or me, you know, you're like the ladder guy and I'm the engine guy. maybe his vocational life is he just wanted to be the chief's aide and figured out learning how to drive might be the best way to go.
Hey, that could be it. Illinois firefighters survived a rollover in the middle of last month in November, and everybody was belted in, and although the truck suffered severe damage, all aboard were belted in, and there were no serious injuries. Seatbelts do work. Seatbelts do work. As it relates to that, as far as the well-known seatbelt project that we're working on, the last of the 120 firefighters that were being body scanned is concluding this month. The report is going to be written, and that report and its findings will be available after the first of the year. Jen promises to get that done. And then that report is going to be forwarded on to NIOSH, where a grant application is being put in for $1 million-plus grant, where we're going to body scan 2,000 or 3,000 firefighters from all across the country, and it will start the largest firefighter health and safety initiative I think that's ever been accomplished in this country. Nobody's ever done anything like this as far as sizing up firefighters, doing a range of motion, and a health and safety study, so we're very excited about what 2008 brings as far as the seatbelt study goes. A vehicle in the Greenwood Fire Department that they've been trying to replace failed an inspection. What do we do, Tom, when we have fire trucks that fail inspection?
Well, I think the NFPA maintenance and inspection standard was a good place to start, where they establishes criteria for when you have to make notification to get the unit repaired as compared to when the unit would have to be taken out of service. Now, if you're saying it failed an inspection, was it implying, Mike, that it failed like its annual mechanical inspection?
Yes, that's correct. It was a 1982 school bus that the department used to transport equipment. And again, another voter discontent. They had a referendum in August where the voters voted 44-30 against purchasing a surplus 92 Ford Command Rescue vehicle. They rejected a $225,000 request to replace that bus that has now failed inspection.
Well,
so talk about being between a rock and a hard place, huh?
Yeah, well, I guess a couple of thoughts. If you just take what kind of vehicle it was out of the equation for a second, and just that somebody presented to you the case that we have a 1982 vehicle and it failed its annual state safety and mechanical inspection, I guess a reasonable person would have to say, okay, let's look at this. 1982, we've got a vehicle that's 25 years of age plus. What failed and what's it going to take to fix it? What's the dollar impact of what it's going to take to go fix it? Obviously, in the fire service, we are reliant upon this apparatus, particularly in the volunteer segment, where depending upon the number of runs that you do, this unit sits stationary in a building in a heated fire station for some period of time, but then it's expected to perform immediately without having any kind of mechanical failure. You now interject the fact that this thing was a school bus. Why did the school district get rid of the school bus? A, probably because it was old, getting up in mileage, and possibly costing them too much money to keep on the road. So who inherits this? The fire department. And you take the scenario, Mike, and it's like a lot of other things. You look at some of these unfortunate injury or fatality incidents relating around tankers. Some people in the manufacturing sector say, geez, tankers have taken a bad rap here because of how we're building them today and all the other safety features that we have, starting as something as simple as baffling inside the tank. Well, then you look at it and say, well, what's the year and vintage, make and manufacture of some of these tankers that are involved in the injury and fatality incidents? And you find out it was an old military surplus chassis with a home-built tank, or a tank that came off some other vehicle, or maybe a vehicle that came out of another vocation, like the school bus. You know, in the commercial world, why do people get rid of something? Because, A, it's either unsafe, mechanically not reliable, or it's costing them too much money to keep on the street. And then we in the fire service, we pick this unit up and think it's a bargain. You know, if you got a 25-year-old school bus, Mike, I don't know about you, but we both live in the same state here where school district taxes are pretty heavy. Maybe this afternoon I should flag down some of the school buses that pass my house, but I'm guessing you'd be hard-pressed to find anything older than about a 10- or 12-year-old bus running down the street. I don't think the school districts here run 25-year-old buses. Maybe that fire department should have gotten out of that thing, and unfortunately, as you mentioned, they were voted down to buy the new rig, but the newer used unit. But unfortunately, because the fire service has always had this can-do attitude, we think that we can pick up somebody else's, frankly, in many cases, piece of junk and turn it into some valuable resource for the fire department. And the community's happy as heck because there's been cost avoidance, but then they just think that we can keep doing this forever. And sooner or later, as in this particular poor department's case, it kind of comes back to haunt them.
Well, and here's another case in point, and I was actually contacted by these folks from Wilton. They just have a multitude of problems that maybe we can discuss. Problem one is the department's 2000 squad truck, which does not meet federal standards as an emergency vehicle. And again, somebody took a chassis, and it said right on the manufacturer plate not to be used as an emergency vehicle, and they tried to turn it into an emergency vehicle. So then, to fix that, they talked about getting a reconverted ambulance that's been offered to the town for $15,000. So again, we're still not talking about buying a fire truck, but basically somebody else's old worn-out problem. And then it goes on to say that the selectmen spent $23,000 to refurbish a tanker truck that a year later is now no longer roadworthy. They actually attempted to auction the unit off on eBay and attracted a bid of $25.50 as the only bid. And this is a department that they bought the 2000 squad truck for $20,000, and it's now worth about $9,000. And the feeling is that the truck is no longer safe on the road because it's carrying way too much weight for what it was designed to carry. Any comments about this department?
Well, I guess a couple of things. Someone many, many years ago said that if you're looking to purchase something, then this just goes out to the general consumer market beyond emergency products or emergency fire apparatus, and says if it appears that the price is too good to be true, it probably is. Now, that was a very, very wise individual. You know, in several of our more recent podcasts to the audience, we briefly spoke about buying used apparatus. If your department or emergency service organization needs to supplement or change your fleet of apparatus, and it becomes evident to you early on that you do not have sufficient funds to buy a new fire truck, that not necessarily is a cause to pause and throw up your hands and say, well, I guess we just have to keep running what we're doing. There are many departments out in the United States that have sufficient funding streams and replace their current apparatus on a reasonably frequent basis. By reasonably frequent, we're talking about something shorter than the typical 15 to 20 year life cycle that many people expect to get out of an emergency vehicle, and they decide the unit's declared surplus, and depending upon the municipality and their governmental regulations, the fire department may be empowered that they can sell it directly to another agency, or it might have to go out to a broker or just be taken in trade on whatever they're buying new. So having said that, this really goes to, if you're going to buy a used piece of equipment, the best adage is that advice that Michael and Tom can give you is, and this is not to scare you, but it's a reality, is let the buyer beware. If you are dealing with to look at a used piece of apparatus, to go to the couple of scenarios that Mike just described, a school bus was never designed to be an emergency vehicle. I've seen them in use in some departments where they use it simply just to transport members around to different events. Okay, it's a transportation device, just its intended purpose. It was not designed to be an emergency vehicle. If you're looking to take an emergency vehicle, similar to the second case that Michael described, a used ambulance, why do you think the agency that owned that before got rid of it? A, probably mechanically unsound, costing them too much money, or in the case of an ambulance, without a doubt, it's already probably past its life cycle in terms of mileage and the expectations that you're going to get out of it. I can't conceive why a rational person would pay $15,000 to buy any kind of used ambulance if you're looking to put it into emergency service in a non-transport mode. At that point, go out on the internet, Google used fire trucks. It's not Michael and I here to represent any one of the companies, but there are more than a couple of very reliable, honest, trustworthy used fire apparatus brokers in the United States. And if nothing else, you can find out what used apparatus in the type and vintage that you're looking to purchase, what it's going to cost you to go buy that. That enables you at least to become somewhat educated as to what in the marketplace. Mike, you mentioned it. Somebody bought a used tanker and then sunk $20,000 plus into it in the first year?
That's correct, yes. Yep. And now it's no longer roadworthy after expending that money from a group, obviously, that didn't have any money to waste at all.
You know, if your department, again, used apparatus can be a great way to get you past the hurdle. If you have a need for a piece of equipment but do not have the ability to, because of your funding streams, to buy a new rig, again, to repeat, that doesn't mean you throw your hands up and say, we got to live with what we've got. But if you're going to go out and start seriously investigating a piece of used apparatus, if you don't have the mechanical maintenance talent within your department, do not be afraid to go seek out a larger department and befriend their mechanic or an outside independent mechanic who might be doing your work and bring them along with you to assess the capabilities of the unit that you're about to inquire on purchasing, whether you're buying it from a broker or buying it directly from another fire department. If the other fire department is selling the rig, it makes sense, but it certainly bears repeating. They're getting rid of it for some reason. You know, in the southern part of New York, for example, where Michael and I have a fair amount of experience, and the departments down there are all tax-supported and very well-funded, and they're getting rid of a 12-year-old rig. Why? Because in their estimation, the rig's getting old, and they're going to go buy a new rig. That's one scenario. If you're going out to some department in the heartland of our country, and you're looking at a 27-year-old commercial chassis pumper tanker, there's a good chance that that department has already gotten their money's worth out of it, and they're simply finally been able to buy either a new rig or a newer used rig, and they have no longer any use for that. That's another whole scenario. That doesn't mean that that 27-year-old rig can't get you past the hump, but in most cases, if you're looking to buy a used piece of apparatus, in any event, you're trying to have something that meets the current NFPA standards in most of the safety areas. The piece of apparatus, if it's something that you're going to ride personnel on beyond the driver and the officer, the driver and the passenger, you want to make sure you're buying a four-door enclosed piece of equipment that at minimum meets the intent of the NFPA safety standards that were in effect back in the early 90s when many of the regulations and requirements for the 1901 standard changed. And if you have any questions on this, please do not hesitate to contact Michael or myself, or simply get the advice of someone in the know. So before you go out and invest, like that poor department that spent $15,000 to buy a used ambulance, if that's the amount of money you have to spend, you need to spend it wisely and not do it on a whim or, frankly, fall in love with the first thing you find or look at, thinking that this is going to be the answer to your problems, because in many cases you'll find out it's just not. And I realize in some cases, probably for our audience, we're kind of preaching to the choir here, but as you get out into the mainstream of the fire service, you find out as a result of some of the articles that Michael has discussed and with the assistance of Peter Matthews as he forwards this information to us, that comes off the news wires on almost a daily basis. Unfortunately, to our listeners, there is a great disparity between the departments that are well-funded and the haves, and those people that are not funded well or have to struggle along or do a lot of outside ancillary fundraising. You know, we joke a lot because of, in Michael and my experience, we've been associated with departments that had pretty strong funding streams, and in our area of the country, we're not doing chicken barbecues and car washes for fundraising efforts to go make money. But I can assure you there's a lot of places where Michael and I have traveled that that's exactly the case, that these people do these things, and when they say they're doing a chicken barbecue for a fundraiser, that's a fundraiser to buy equipment and or apparatus. And there's a lot of areas of the country that are in that position, and we want to help be able to get the information out, so if people are going to make a purchasing decision, whether it's a new rig, which we tend to write and talk a lot about, or a used piece of equipment, which is even more important because it's a significant sum of money for departments that are in that particular situation. You want to become an educated consumer and make a good purchasing decision, and frankly, not buy somebody else's problem, thinking that, hey, you know, you're going to figure out how to go make this work.
Thank you very much, Tom. Appreciate that. A couple more news items. We spoke last month about Newham Fire Department out in the Midwest, who had a town board governing body that left it up to the fire department to go and drink and cut each other off. And now new word out of there that they're going to draft an alcohol use response policy as per a report from the city manager. So just an update there. We'll keep you apprised of that situation in the weeks and months ahead. Everybody is familiar by now with the National Safety Stand Down Week that we've had the last couple years, courtesy of the International Association of Fire Chiefs. Well, it was just released earlier this week that the National Safety Stand Down will now become known as the Fire EMS Safety, Health, and Survival Week, and it's going to be held this year, June 22 to June 28th. So training officers out there and chiefs, get some information together and get a program together to be held during Fire EMS Safety, Health, and Survival Week. And again, that's June 22 to 28. And again, we'll have more on that. And finally, chief concerns firefighting equipment shortfall might be addressed through a lease, and it's something that Tom and I just wrote about for Firehouse Magazine that you can view in October. But at a council work session, a fire chief introduced a plan to suggest the city should lease its frontline firefighting equipment over the next 10 years rather than replacing trucks one at a time. Your thoughts on that, Tom?
Well, I think as municipal budgets continue to get strained to the point where in some locales you're reaching the practical limit of the taxable limit of what the municipality can levy back upon its citizens, if you look at in other departments within the municipality, traditionally, whether we're talking about roads and streets or police vehicles, and certainly now we're talking specifically about emergency vehicles, the perception has been that we have to purchase that and buy it outright. Because of the cost, attendant cost, versus the life cycle, anticipated life cycle of some of these pieces of our apparatus and equipment, particularly when you look at in the roads and streets or public works sector, several years ago, managers in that segment determined that it was more cost effective, and rather than worrying about having a year where the municipality was, you know, would absorb a large bonding cost to take the cost of that particular piece of equipment and amortize it over, you know, a 10 or 15 or in some cases 20 year life expectancy of the bond when they were be bonding, you know, other major municipal construction projects, you know, and infrastructure improvements, that they found that really, you know, it got them the new equipment when they needed it, but from a cost standpoint, it was costing the community an exorbitant amount of money over the life of the bond to be paying for that when you started to look at the bonding cost and the interest cost. Now, you take that one step further and go into the fire service. We've spoken and written at length about talking about that the life cycle of fire apparatus that traditionally was 15 to 20 years, in many, many communities, that is no longer applicable because of the number of incidents each year that you're responding to, the type of calls, and the annual mileage that apparatus is accumulating. In many cases, departments, particularly in the urban areas, are finding that maybe an 8 to 10 year life cycle is more practical from a number of perspectives. That being the case, to take a look at the whatever the you would perceive to be the average cost of a custom Class A pumper today, let's just throw out a figure of $350,000 each. If you have a reasonably large fleet of units, you're fronting, you know, 10 to 15 engine companies, and you're looking for a 15-year life expectancy, well, then it'd be pretty easy to figure out that you need to buy 1 to 2 pumpers every year. If you're going to have 10 to 15 frontline units, you need to have a minimum of 4 or 5 in the reserve or spare fleet as a bare minimum. So that means you got 20 engines total, and even if you took the 10-year mark, only because the math works out pretty easily, you need to buy 2 a year. Well, what happens the year when you're the fire chief in a career department where maybe the other municipal unions are negotiating contracts, or the school district needs is out for significant funding levels, and you're the head chief executive officer in the city, be it a mayor or the city manager, comes and says, Chief Wilbur, you know, we know you need your 2 pumpers again this year like you did last year, but looks like this year and certainly next year, because we're giving your people a raise, we're giving you a raise, and by the way, we're going to give you a new, you know, Ford Crown Vic, of course, unmarked, of course, so you can go out to the food store, you know, on Saturdays, and nobody's going to know you're the fire chief. Not that you, I think, Mike, your picture is in Firehouse, so they probably would identify you in the food market. Isn't that true?
Pretty much, Tom, yeah.
Okay, but at any rate, you know, as the mayor, I'm telling you, for the next 2 years, no money for fire trucks. So you as fire chief say, okay, well, we'll suck it up, and, you know, we're going to have to pump up our maintenance budget a little bit, and for the next 2 years we buy nothing. Well, then what happens when year 3 rolls around? Do you think the community is going to pony up money now, not just for 2, but now you need 6 pumpers, and now they're not $350,000 each because inflation and NFPA requirements have changed, as they're going to change in the sometime in the third quarter of next year and add some more money to the cost of rigs. Now the units are like $390,000 each. And when you go apply your case in front of the city fathers, they're going to say, geez, Chief Wilbur, just 2 years ago these were $350,000. Now you're telling me they're $390,000, and now you want 6 of these. How about we give you half of them? And you say, okay, because you don't want to get beat up. You come home and you tell your fleet manager, well, I asked for 6, but I got 3. Well, sooner or later, as they say, you have to pay the piper here. You know, it doesn't. The lunch doesn't come for free. It only looks momentarily like you can go through the buffet line and fill up, you know, with as many times as you want. Sooner or later, your fleet now begins to deteriorate right out from underneath you. Enter leasing. If a leasing program can be set up so that you have a fixed sum of money that has to be expensed every year, and at the end of the life cycle of the vehicle, the manufacturer gives you a figure that he's either going to buy the rig back, or there's a payout figure. You can keep it if you want it. In most cases, departments are looking at, if you're a busy urban department, at the end of that 7 to 8 year period, you get rid of the vehicles and you replace them all new. Now, if you do that, design it with good components, have extended warranties in some cases, you find out your maintenance costs can actually level out, or in some cases, appropriately designed, they can decrease because you're dealing with a newer fleet of equipment that part of it, or parts of the components on these vehicles, are covered under warranty, and the expense for any failures or replacement costs there are absorbed by the warranty side rather than being absorbed by the municipal budget from a maintenance standpoint. So there's a lot of benefits in there that sometimes can assist the community instead of the fire chief, frankly, having to go hat in hand unless there's an agreed-to replacement program and it's going to be funded every year. The problem becomes in a lot of governmental areas that we think of the fire service as being the pillar of the community. If you roll into town and there's a bronze statue in the center of the town square, it's going to be of the firefighters, because we just consider ourselves to be kind of immune from all these other public pressures. The fact of the matter is, we are trying to contribute to the community health and welfare, but we are also, we are a part of the whole municipal budget that in some areas, right behind the DPW and sometimes the police, based on the side of the police force, not to talk negatively about our other brothers in blue, but fire departments tend to be one of the two top three highly budgeted agencies within a municipality if you have career staffing. Just goes with the territory. And we're competing for that budget money, no different than the police chiefs competing for the money and the public works guy is competing for money. So if it comes down to we need a new snow plow to plow the streets, if you happen to be in any area that gets that white stuff, we're competing against the police department to improve their communication system and to get new police cars that people see running up and down the road every day, or we're competing to try to get some monies for us for pumpers, and you know, we don't have a strong case to build, or we don't have a strong relationship with the other department heads in the other portions of the community. Based on some of those press wires that Peter Matthews has forwards to Michael and myself, and our listeners get to hear those things, based on what you're reading, how many times do you think the fire service wins versus the fire service ends up coming up on the short end of the stick? If you lose a vote by a, you know, to buy a used fire truck by a couple of votes in a municipality, it's kind of painting a particular picture to me that we don't enjoy that pristine reputation that sometimes we think we have as an emergency service provider. So with that, we'll take a short break and we'll be back in just a few minutes.
Help me out here. TFT has the industry's broadest line of fire suppression equipment, yet everyone thinks we're just nozzles. Sure, we've got all the fixed, selectable, and automatic handheld nozzles you'd ever want, but we also have great foam injection and application equipment, amazing manual and remote control monitors, high-flowing intake valves, and leak-proof suction hose. So if you're specking a new apparatus, go to www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686. TFT makes over 2,300 products. We're not just nozzles anymore.
Welcome back to the Apparatus Architects. This is Mike Wilbur along with Tom Shan. At the break, Tom was talking about municipalities and fundings, and one of the things that I feel quite strongly about, having seen some of the suffering by local fire departments, is that town or city government needs to determine if they want to have a fire department. And if the answer to that is yes, then the town or the city needs to come up with an appropriate funding stream to fund the fire department, because running a fire department costs X amount of dollars. And really, when you look at it from a national perspective, especially in these trying times post 9/11, the fire department is the first line of defense on a home front versus the military throughout. And many, many times, as Tom has stated, and Peter sends us stuff over the wires, that municipalities are just completely underfunding the fire departments to the point where it becomes dangerous to operate, whether it's the vehicles or the lack of proper equipment or safety initiatives altogether, and it becomes a very dangerous environment in which to volunteer one's time. And so we're really pleading with city managers and town officials, you know, determine if you want to have a fire department. And if you do, fire trucks, fire equipment, and having a fire department costs X amount of dollars. And in some cases, fire departments and city managers try to go on the L cheap. And it's, of course, human nature to maybe try and do that. But we find out, just like in everyday living, if you buy cheap, you get cheap. Well, in the fire service, particularly with fire apparatus, if you buy cheap, it's not that much cheaper over the course of the life expectancy of the truck, give it 15 or 20 years to amortize that money, than it is to buy something that's relatively well built and good. And the reality becomes, if you think that you're saving money by buying something quote unquote cheap or low bid, then please take that money that you save, put it into an account, and add about 20% to that per year, because that's what it's going to cost to keep that other apparatus on the road. Fire protection costs X amount of dollars, and it's kind of a pay me now, pay me later kind of proposition. But we need to get a government to properly fund the fire service.
Yeah, Mike, so much of what we do in the emergency service area is depending upon having the appropriate staffing levels and equipment that enables us to do our job. Now, that sounds kind of just pretty straightforward and like, geez, I don't think you need to be the proverbial rocket scientist to figure that one out. But unless we have that funding level available to us to enable us to have the appropriate, starts out with staffing, right, then followed very closely by training, and then the equipment that enable us to perform our job functions effectively and safely, that in many cases we're putting our own personnel at extreme risk above and beyond what would normally be encountered as an acceptable level of risk, simply to try to offset the fact that we don't have adequate, in some cases, equipment, in many cases, training, and most importantly, staffing levels that enable us to do our job functions effectively, no matter what the size of the department is. So, at any rate, very important words. Moving on, there's been some discussions lately and some inquiries that people have made into Michael and myself through Firehouse Magazine or contacting us directly regarding the testing of pumping apparatus at a manufacturer's facility when you're taking in the process of doing the final inspection and then what will ultimately be the acceptance and then of the apparatus at your community's location. And this is specifically to do with the pump and the piping assemblies. Understand that when a unit is, people refer to it as third-party testing. Sometimes they refer to it as the UL pump test, and UL being, you know, the trade name for Underwriters Laboratories, that a lot of manufacturers do actually use Underwriters Labs. Other apparatus manufacturers have contracts with other testing companies to do their certification testing on the fire pump from draft to make sure that it will produce its rated capacity, 100% of rated capacity, then 70% and 50% at the different pump pressures as outlined in the 1901 standard. Understand that when that test is done at the manufacturer's location, the apparatus is not necessarily 100% complete. It is operationally complete that enables the test to be conducted, in that obviously all the pump and plumbing have to be in place, all the warning lights have to be there together with the unit's equipped with the generator, all the 120-volt appliances have to be on and operational during the duration of the test. But that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, the vehicle in some cases maybe isn't even roadworthy. You couldn't drive it down the street the way it is the day they roll it out on the test pit. And while that test is vitally important, in essence, it means that on that particular date and time, at the percentage of completion that the vehicle was at, that the unit passed those particular certification test points. Where we're driving at is that there's been reports from several departments that with a certain brand of fire pump, they were using a composite-type material for the check valve that is in the tank, the pump line. And typically, it's a 3-inch line. In some cases, you could have dual tank-to-pump lines depending upon the physical size of the water tank. But there is a check valve in there, and that check valve has been a requirement in the 1901 standard for many, many years, that if you're operating off the water tank on the fire ground and then you then get a supply line put into the pump and you're now operating under a positive residual pressure, that check valve is designed to automatically close so you don't backfill water into the tank unnecessarily. You then would open up your supply line, open up the tank fill line, and refill the tank in case something happens to your supply line that you still have now a full tank of water. Well, one pump manufacturer saw fit to use a composite type material in this tank to pump line for the check valve, as compared to making it out of some type of metal, i.e., for example, brass. Well, with the number of units that are out there that have this composite tank to pump line, in addition to the fact that this composite check valve would not necessarily seat all the way. More importantly, in some cases, this particular composite device actually disintegrated, fractured, and then takes these little pieces of this composite plastic material and puts it throughout your pump and plumbing system, which obviously can tear the heck out of a lot of your other discharge piping and possibly even cause damage to the fire pump. So what you want to do if you're purchasing a new piece of apparatus to absolutely ensure that the vehicle is going to operate properly is to do a couple of things. During the acceptance portion of the testing that you do at your location, if your fire department is blessed to have a training facility that has pump testing facilities, you certainly want to take it over there and at least do an abbreviated version. Again, the NFPA guidelines are excellent here, the standards. Do a standard 40-minute service test on the unit to do a miniature version of the longer certification testing that's done at the manufacturing site to ensure that the unit performs to those criteria. More importantly, it is incumbent upon the fire department to take every discharge on that piece of apparatus and flow water through that discharge, including cross lays, left side, right side, rear discharges, trash lines, deck gun, however many discharges you have on there. Understand that when the unit undergoes the testing certification at the manufacturer's plant, call it the UL test, they only use the requisite number of discharges that are necessary to flow. If you have a 1500 GPM pump, you only need three discharges to get 1500 gallons a minute through, that they are not going to physically test and flow water through every discharge on the apparatus. That is not required in the standard, not part of the test, and that's one of the things beyond the hydrostatic test that the manufacturer would do. That just ensures that the piping is tight and that there's no physical leaking in the plumbing. Doesn't mean, for example, if you wrote a performance spec and put in, for example, rear discharges shall be capable of 500 GPM each at an appropriate pump pressure with a friction loss not to exceed, say, 25 PSI. Right? If you want to test for that performance, the fire department needs to do that. That is not something that is automatically done by the manufacturer. And again, it is incumbent upon the fire department to do that testing. Specifically, if you might want to inquire if your specifications did not dictate a certain type of material for that check valve to be manufactured of, to inquire with the your apparatus builder, what's the check valve made out of? And if it's not made out of a pretty stout metal-type material, you may want to inquire on that and get that corrected before you go put the unit in the service into your community and then find out you've got all kinds of problems. But most importantly, you need to get that testing done and have it done in addition to doing it annually. If you're taking delivery of a new rig, you want to make sure that you get that done before you accept and then ultimately pay for the apparatus. Just vitally, vitally important. Doesn't sound like it would be all that big a deal, but after you pay for and accept the rig, while most manufacturers will certainly stand behind the warranty, you've paid for the new unit and you'd like to have the rig perform the way you would want and not have the unit taken out of service and have unexpected downtime on the rig. So that's something you kind of want to take a look at. And Mike, I know that you had some interest. We talked about pumpers, and let's throw it back over to you for the aerial ladder portion. If you have some concerns, it seems like there's a lot of departments that are going from a traditional ladder truck, or possibly where it's even more important, no ladder company at all, and having interest in purchasing some type of tower ladder, and then trying to figure out how they're going to use and deploy the unit once they take delivery of it. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, we have we get contacted often here and have many cases to interact with departments, Tom, where the departments have been able to gather funding to go out and spend $600 or $700 or $800 or $900 and in some cases over $1 million for an aerial tower or a tractor drone or whatever the rig du jour is that they're going to want in their communities. And one of the things that they fail to do is to include monies in the bid price or in their training budgets to get trained on the truck. And this happens over and over again. If you, as a department, are going to go out and expend funds of that magnitude, particularly for first-time aerial or tower users, you need to have some kind of funding mechanism to get proper training on a truck. When the delivery agent delivers the truck, they are not going to train you. In fact, I believe, and Tom, you can correct me here, but the NFPA now calls that a demonstration when the manufacturer comes in. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's the terminology. I know in most cases, because of, and I'm sure you're going to be headed down this road, from a product liability standpoint, just about every aerial manufacturer that I'm aware of, if you take delivery of a vehicle, let's just say it's, for sake of argument, it's a rear mount tower, does not have a pump or tank on it. The person initially, the local dealer or salesperson that's going to physically drive the unit in the town, may do familiarization training with you in terms of the chassis, how to check fluid levels, proper tire pressures, take you through the electrical system on the vehicle, and that's about as far as it's going to go. The manufacturer will send in a trained delivery engineer to train you how to operate the vehicle in terms of how to set up and engage the power takeoff, how to set up the stabilizers, how the controls operate, how the emergency backup system operates on the aerial tower device. More often than not, typically do that simply in a parking lot. They are not training you how to operate the unit and position it in town at the scene of an emergency. Even if the unit is equipped with a fire pump, unless you inquire, you may or may not get training on actually taking and flowing water through the device. Michael and I would certainly encourage you to have that done. But the training you get is operational training on how the unit functions and what to do if it doesn't function the way it's supposed to when everything works right.
Well, this problem of not having any tactical training or positioning training has gone on for really a long time. If we go back in history, when the fire service first became motorized in the late 20s, you may have purchased your first aerial ladder truck. A guy, and now we call them delivery engineers, but at that time they really didn't even have a term for them, would come to the fire station with your new ladder truck and would tell you that this switch did this, this knob did this, this lever did that. Have a nice day. And it was really left up to the fire department to figure out what to do with this truck. And depending on how much training the fire department did and what kind of activity level they had as far as going to fires, depended on what they figured out and what kind of experience that they gained using this truck. And the truck would stay in service for 20 or 25 or 30 years. And then we're on to the next vintage truck. And some of the more experienced members on the truck may or may not have been around for the next vintage of the truck. And then we move it up now to 2007, 2008, and we have people delivering trucks, these delivery engineers, who are basically going to teach the given fire departments about every safety switch and every jack plate and every warning label on the truck. And if you talk to these individuals and get them off the beaten path and get their guard down a little bit, they will actually admit that basically, it's an endeavor now to try and instruct firefighters on all the safety features of this vehicle so that the manufacturer doesn't incur a lawsuit. The reality is that a high percentage, upwards of 90 to 95% of all aerial devices getting delivered are getting delivered by delivery engineers who've never had aerial or tower ladders to fires. And so what they offer is not tactical training, but just operational training or operational demonstration, and we're really lacking in the proper techniques on how to operate and position aerial and tower ladders on the fire ground. And if you are going to purchase a new aerial or tower, or even we've done some used training as well, where departments have purchased used apparatus to get into the aerial market as first-time aerial users or tower users, you really need to set funds aside to get somebody to come in and provide you training on that apparatus from a firefighter and a fire ground perspective rather than just an operational perspective.
Well, Mike, to that point, in the last 3 months, I've had the good fortune of attending several pre-construction conferences with customers, and I'll give you two opposite ends of the extreme. One, good size, major department that operates three ladder companies with one in reserve, is doing a pre-construction conference on a new rear-mounted device to replace an older rear-mounted 100-foot ladder that they currently have in service. Attending at the pre-construction conference was a deputy chief of operations, captain from the training division, a gentleman who oversees the maintenance shops, and two individuals from the company that is slated to take the delivery of this unit. Nice mixture in terms of years of experience and the talent levels, but most importantly, the different areas of disciplines within that career fire department. The training that that department gets when they receive that new unit will be along the lines of what you've just described. And because of the fire duty that they do in that department and the fact that they have an operational training division to oversee that tactical training, that department, I'm very confident, will be well-trained and versed when they go back that new unit into the station after they've gone through the training that they're going to receive at the local level above and beyond what's going to be supplied by the manufacturer. There's scenario one. Scenario two, a department in the central part of the United States that was doing a pre-construction conference for several vehicles, including their first purchased aerial device that they've ever had in the department. For a number of years, they've relied on a neighboring jurisdiction to supply a ladder truck when they needed it, and these people fortunately did a great job in selling the needs for this particular department to their township fathers, and the township ponied up enough money with this good size all volunteer organization to purchase both a non-walk-in rescue and a rear-mounted Quint device. Within that all-volunteer department, there are a couple of brothers that are career firefighters in a jurisdiction a couple miles down the road that operates a five-station, fairly sizable, all-career department that has a couple of different aerial devices. So within that particular volunteer organization, they have folks that have ladder company experience based on where they gain that in their career department. However, the device that they operate in their career department, different make, different manufacturer, but at least they have an idea or a clue as to how the vehicle needs to be set up and positioned on the fire ground, yet they inquired what kind of outside tactical type training that Michael just mentioned should they be getting to further enhance their capabilities. So when they take delivery of their new $750-some-odd-thousand-dollar Quint, they're going to look pretty sharp and polished on the fire ground when they go to position this. It's not going to look like you've just flipped your car keys to your 16-year-old, and after he just got his driving test, watch him try to back up the first time out of the driveway. It can be a little bit humorous. But more importantly, to go to Michael's point, if you are buying a used piece of aerial apparatus, this is highly important, particularly if your department has never owned any kind of ladder truck before. Not only do you not know anything about the tactical operations, but let's suppose you go out and buy a 15-year-old 100-foot rear mount device that was built by a very good manufacturer, somebody that's still in business today. Unless you're willing to pick up the phone and call that manufacturer and have them send somebody out, you're buying that rig, and as we mentioned earlier in the podcast, buyer beware. That manufacturer has no implied liability to try to come out and train you because you're now purchasing that on a used basis. So not only do you not know how to operate the vehicle on the fire ground or how to position it or how it can be used offensively versus defensively, other than what that other fire department's going to hand you, maybe if you're at least lucky enough, the operating manuals, all right, that'll probably be somewhat curled up and ragged-eared, there's not going to be anybody to guide you through and tell you other than what the purchasing department or the vendor tells you. Well, this button does this, this button does this. Oh, yeah, that button, that was disconnected. That never did work right, so it's not hooked to anything, so don't worry about that. Just put tape over that and you'll be all set. You are now really going down the road where bad things can happen unless you get educated and properly trained on the apparatus. And just because you couldn't afford to buy a new one is not a reason not to go look at buying a used piece of apparatus. But the worst case scenario that I can think of is you're coming from never having owned a ladder company before. You buy something from another department and all you get is, you know, their operating manuals and a pat on the shoulder and say, thanks for your check, good luck, and you drive that thing 130 miles back to your station and you're left to your own devices, how to figure out how to operate it, how to operate it safely. If you haven't had your mechanic look at it, if you don't have somebody to come in from the outside, whether it's you hire the manufacturer to come in and train you as to how to operate that vintage rig and get some tactical training from outside of the department, you are really operating, or as they would used to call it, you're skating on thin ice. So much more than let the buyer beware, that might be the easiest part of your purchase. You need to seriously consider getting some training on how to properly operate and safely set up and use that unit so you don't find yourself getting yourself even in deeper trouble than anything you may have expected.
Well, thank you for those comments, Tom. Appreciate that. I know you have some information for us on equipment weights and sizes and how that interfaces with equipment inventories on the apparatus.
Yeah, we're going to finish up today's podcast and just talking a little bit and trying to expand upon what Michael and I have written in the past about developing apparatus and equipment inventories when you're purchasing a new piece of equipment. Once again, we refer to the Bible as the NFPA 1901 standard that outlines pretty successfully what the minimum weight requirements are if you're buying a new pumper. It's either 2,000 or 2,500 pounds based on the cubic foot capacity of the body, and a ladder company is 2,500 pounds. And special service units have different weight requirements if you're designing any kind of heavy rescue or rescue squad or USAR unit, depending upon what part of the country you happen to hail from. Well, we've talked about it in the past, but it certainly it bears repeating that the more that Michael and I get out and work and detail information with fire departments, that they seem to be largely clueless unless they have an existing rig that they're already replacing that gives them the benefit of having a starting point of at least saying, well, here's what we carry today, and we know we want to carry more stuff. The problem becomes identifying for our listeners what that additional stuff is and how much it weighs. And there are two opposite scenarios where this can either, in either event, it comes back to kind of bite the fire department. In one case, if you've ever operated an older vehicle that was severely underpowered or you found out that it was overweight, and Mike and I can speak volumes to having different departments that we visited over the years, and these are not necessarily relegated to just old units. We're not talking about 1972 Max CF pumpers that have bolt-on compartments on the, you know, both sides of the body and the roof. We're talking about apparatus that's built within the last 10 years that's severely overweight, where people have not taken the time to identify exactly how much equipment they plan on carrying. To put things in perspective, if you take that typical mid-1980s pumper, and we realize for some of the listeners that might be a stretch to go back that far, but it really isn't, all right, where the unit had high side compartments on the left side of the body, it had ladders mounted in a standard, as they would refer to it, pumper configuration on the right, you'd end up with having four compartments on the right, on the left side, one in the rear, two on the right, you'd have a total of seven compartments. In that era, it was pretty difficult to put 2,000 pounds of equipment in that body, even to get close to it. Now we look at today's design, where people like to have rescue pumper body designs where there's full height, full depth compartments on both sides of the body. There's a hydraulic ladder rack or the ladders are enclosed within the body or through the tank, and there's still that rear compartment. So we've gone from having 7 compartments on a unit that you count them up and say, well, there's still 3 on each side and 1 in the back. Geez, Tom, there's still only 7 compartments. But now the cubic foot storage capacity of that body has changed dramatically. And we haven't given up anything on our hose load. We still want to carry 750 gallons of water, or in some cases even more. And the manufacturer figures, okay, well, they're going to add 2,000 pounds of equipment together with the specified hose load. You buy the unit, you throw everything from your existing engine onto that. You're lucky enough to get some kind of grant, or if you're in the state of New York, you get that proverbial pork barrel money, and the local state legislator lays $75,000 on your fire department, and you go out and you buy a brand new rescue tool system, and that's all cool stuff. But, you know, that has a weight alone of all of that stuff of at least 700 to 800 pounds, depending on what you buy. And then the next thing, you start getting some shoring and other blocking material, and you buy an airbag set, and you put an air card on there. And pretty soon you find out that in addition to the engine company stuff that didn't even come close to the 2,000 pounds of weight, you've now added 1,100 pounds worth of rescue stuff. And all that's good, but unless you plan for that, your unit is either A, going to be overloaded on the rear axle, or at the very least, the weight distribution from the left side to the right side of the body might not be very good. After the warranty wears off, some evening you walk into the station, and if your station has deep enough double bays, you stand back and look at the rear of the rescue engine and see it's severely leaning to the left, and you're trying to figure out why. And then you crawl underneath and you look at the springs and find out, wow, the springs are flattened out on the left side. How did that happen? Well, you find out that you got a lot more weight on one side of the body than you have on the other. All of this sounds pretty straightforward. It's like the recipe for making a cake. You need to follow each step in the recipe. If you skip one at the end of the show, you don't get the cake. You get something that's flattened out and doesn't work. So it's really, really important for you to look through everything that you are planning on putting on the piece of apparatus and weigh it. Know the physical size and the weight, so that as it goes on and you check it off the inventory, when you go to do the meeting with your apparatus builder, and if you haven't done it before the point of going to bid, you absolutely need to have that information at the time when you do your pre-construction or your pre-build conference, so you can submit to the apparatus manufacturer and put the ball in their court as to how much of a storage capacity in terms of size and weight you plan on putting on the vehicle. Failing to do that, the onus of responsibility now goes back over to the fire department, and if there's any problem in the warranty period, more often than not, my experience has been the fire department owns the problem, not the manufacturer. So, once again, if you have any questions relating to this or the best way to how to prepare an inventory, contact Michael and I. We can give you some advice. An excellent resource is available at the Fire Apparatus Manufacturers Association, which is FAMA.org. And they have a downloadable chart there which gives you physical size and weights of many of the types of equipment that we carry on apparatus. It is not specific to a manufacturer. So, for example, if you say it's a PPV fan, we still need those dimensions. Somebody says a PPV fan, you can line up the different products that are out there from the reputable manufacturers, and they vary all over the board. It's not like saying, I just bought a pound of green beans. A pound of green beans, everyone knows what it looks like, and it weighs a pound, and we know what that cube requires. If you have rescue tool equipment, those things, vitally important to be able to weigh and measure that, so that as you work through the process with your apparatus manufacturer, you'll have a good handle as to how all of that is going to work out and go into the body, so you won't find yourself with either an overloaded body or an underloaded unit that performs poorly. So, finishing up today, those are the kinds of things that they're the little details, but as they say, the devil's in the details, and someone in your committee needs to be in charge of formulating that inventory list So when you get to the point of pre-construction with the manufacturer and they say, what's going in this compartment, somebody from the fire department can answer that, and you just don't get a blank stare saying, geez, what do we carry on truck two now? You know, and then you can see there's some debate back and forth. So digital photos, that physical written inventory, if it's going to be a new piece of equipment, have the cut sheet. If you're buying new set of air shores, again, they vary in terms of sizes and weights. Have the cut sheet with you, supply that to the manufacturer, and make sure we, as the fire department, have our act together, which enables then the engineering group with the builder you're working with to be able to do their thing so that everybody will be on the proverbial same sheet of music. So, Michael.
One is that the days of buying a new truck and as it's rolling onto the apparatus apron, unload the old truck and pull it out and back the new truck up and decide at that point in time where the equipment is going to fit, those days are over for good. And just having worked recently with a couple of apparatus committees, the equipment and the location and the mounting and the equipment inventory may not necessarily be the funnest part of speccing out a truck, but certainly the work that the apparatus committee from the local fire department does beforehand certainly makes for a smoother final inspection trip, and certainly it makes for a smoother delivery to get this work done and to get everybody turning from the same page before the project comes to an end and the finger pointing starts. And like you said, the onus is really on the individual fire department and not on the manufacturer when it comes to the equipment and the mounting and the weight distribution. So just a couple thoughts. As we're wrapping up here today, this is our last show for 2007, and we just thought that maybe we would throw out a few predictions for 2008 as it relates to the apparatus industry. What do you have for us, Tom?
Well, I think the handwriting is already starting to be etched on the wall that with some of the more recent announcements as to the way our economy in our country is going and the spending levels within the federal government, that it's going to get more difficult for fire departments to get what we in the past have considered to be our fair share of the budget pot for improve and increase our funding stream and a lot of the different things we do. Having said that, I think that's going to directly impact the fire apparatus market, where we potentially are going to see in the next couple of upcoming years fewer pieces of new fire apparatus purchased, which is not only going to impact the industry, but ultimately is going to impact the fire departments and the users. So where some people may have looked at in the past with somewhat of dim view of the NFPA and their requirements and their guidelines, I think in the future we're going to be relying upon those as managers much more than we had in the past, particularly with respect to the maintenance requirements and things that will give us some distinct leverage in being able to justify, for example, why our maintenance budgets are what they are. You know, our demands for service, unfortunately, in our industry does not go down. All right, there's very few fire departments that I've bumped into in the course of the last 12 to 18 months and say, wow, runs are way down and, you know, we're doing, you know, less runs. And not uncommon to hear people saying we're doing less work. You may be doing, most common phrases, you know, we're doing a lot more running and a lot less work. We're going and doing less work and fires, but we're running a lot more to all the different types of ancillary calls, you know, CO alarms and as the proverbial smells and bells and other things that we get exposed to. And that all equates to wear and tear on the fire apparatus. If we don't replace it on an appropriate life cycle basis, it's only going to increase our maintenance costs. So there's no sense fooling ourselves thinking that we can keep our maintenance budget where it was in the past, or, you know, well, we'll throw like 3 or 4% at it. You know, I was driving home from a business meeting the other day, filled up gas in my car in an upstate New York location, and I think I paid $3.31 a gallon, and I thought of how outrageous that was until I looked up at the sign and saw that diesel fuel was $3.85 a gallon. Well, just about all of our apparatus is diesel powered. If you don't have enough money in for your fuel and maintenance at $3.85 a gallon, what do? Just stop telling the mayor, geez, when we run out of fuel because we overspent our budget there. We're just going to stop going to calls. So another prediction is that maintenance costs and the maintenance programs for our apparatus are going to become much more important than they ever had before, because they're going to come under scrutiny. Fire chiefs and fleet managers are going to be responsible for trying to keep this stuff up and running and keep the downtime to a minimum without exhausting the piggy bank. And that, Michael, I think might be a lot more easier said than done. So,
yeah, just a couple observations that I had for the new year, Tom. I think in a year's time from now, I think that there are not going to be as many manufacturers manufacturing fire trucks as there were in previous years. I think that the industry is going to go through another adjustment period, much like around the 1990s when such noted manufacturers as Maxim, Ward LaFrance, Hahn Motors, Mack, and others went out of business or got sold or got bought up or whatever. So I think that in the manufacturing side that there's going to be an adjustment period here in the next year or two where there's going to be some consolidation, because there's just not going to be enough new apparatus being purchased based on the lack of budget monies and the cost of new apparatus. I think that used apparatus, that market is going to continue to grow at a fairly rapid pace as departments look to alternatives to buying new but still offering quality service to the taxpaying public. And I think rehabs, rehabilitating existing apparatus or buying used apparatus and rehabilitating that to the point of making it NFPA compliant, I think will be a pretty standard fare, as well as fire departments and chief officers and budget gurus try to work within budget constraints to continue to provide the outstanding service that most departments provide.
Well, thanks, Mike. I really appreciate that. And hey, we hope that some of our predictions do not seem dire to the listeners. And if we're proven to be wrong, that would be great. But I think we need to be realists in terms of looking and assessing the situation and looking at what's, you know, out there on the horizon and what we're facing. And while other people, we're not running for political office here in the fire service, that a lot of the proverbial politicians like to paint pictures through rose-colored glasses, we in the fire service, who, as Michael mentioned, you know, first-level responders to just about anything that doesn't involve bullets, and sometimes are even involved with that, that we need to look at from a pragmatic standpoint where we're headed and be prepared for that. We'd rather be, it's the Boy Scout motto, we'd rather be prepared than have to read about it in the paper and find out, we failed to respond. So to all listeners, wish you a very happy and safe Christmas holiday, New Year, and the holiday season in general, and we look forward to not only talking to you, but to meeting you in the upcoming year in 2008.
This is Mike Wilbur
and Tom Shand wishing you all very safe and happy holiday season, and look forward to talking to you the next time on the Apparatus Architects.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.